Robots Radio. Games. Lore. Stories. Community. Just press play.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, weary traveler. Need a short rest? Oh, I see. They said you'd be showing up about now. Come on, through the portal. Best not keep the Lore Mistress and Lore Master waiting. You know how they get.
Robots Radio presents the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. The best way for everyone from experienced dungeon masters to those curious about D&D to learn more about the worlds, creatures, and lore of Dungeons & Dragons.
Hello and welcome to the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. My name is Sergio.
My name is Sean.
And we will be your lore master. And would you consider yourself a lore master?
Like a lore TA.
A lore teacher's apprentice. I was going to say apprentice. That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah.
A lore's teacher's apprentice. And we're here to talk D&D lore each and every week. Hot, fresh, and ready lore. Much like a nice pizza pie, except instead of pepperoni and cheese, you get bugbears and goblins and whatnot.
But it's calorie free, so you can listen to as much as you want.
It's gluten free, it's calorie free. So on any sort of diet, paleo, all that.
Weight Watchers, anything you're doing.
Atkins. We try to South make Beach. This as inclusive as possible. But this, I say inclusive. This week is going to be a gnarly episode. we're talking vile gods. And here's the thing. We had our patron roundtable last week, and we got to talk and with the patrons and talk about what we've been doing the second half of this year, and also talk about why we're grateful, like things we're grateful for in the TTRPG space. And I was like, enough of the all feel gooderies. I want to talk some heinous, awful stuff. I want to talk some vile gods. So we're going to talk about a handful of them in the first half. And then we got a special treat in the second half. So in comparison with gods such as Bane or Vecna, you kind of like the big bads of the BBEGs of the D&D multiverse. The vile gods that we'll be discussing in the first half are relatively minor in comparison. They've only got a few small congregations and cults in their name, but they, you know, what they lack in population, they make up for in enthusiasm.
Right, just like us.
Exactly, they're fervent, excitable fellows. So most people speak these deities' names in fear or not at all, lest they attract a dread god's attention. So the first vile god we're going to discuss is Kharan. So known primarily as the beast god, Kharan, spelled K-A-R-A-A-N, is a monstrous entity of savage lust and wanton destruction. So far, you know, not too like off the grid in terms of vileness.
Nope.
You know, savage lust and wanton destruction. I mean, it sounds like your typical teenage boy playing Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, who among us?
Who among us could not be described as such at one point in their life? So Kharan is normally depicted as a hulking humanoid covered in fur with terrible claws and teeth. Doesn't resemble any specific animal, but just has this sort of general overall predatory appearance. Kharan represents the dark side of nature. Thus, he's like the opposite or the enemy of Obadhai or Elona, more of like the peaceful druidic type deities, you know, the let's bask underneath the shade of a willow tree and watch, you know, bugs crawl around on leaves and just, you know, be at one with the Earth Mother. The complete opposite of that. Often revered in association with Eretnul, although his cults, the cults of Kharan, are much more obscure. A few believe him to be related in some way to Yenaku, though that demon prince is not an actual god. Which, do you think, if you're a demon prince, is it one of those like Dwight Schrute, like assistant regional manager, assistant to the regional manager type thing?
I mean, you'd have to imagine, yeah, like if you've got congregants and stuff, if you're seeking followers, like you would definitely bristle at being called only a demon prince,
right?
In relation to the vile gods.
I would think so. I mean, I would. I speaking as a demon prince adjacent, I would think the ego on a demon prince probably isn't the most secure of things. Probably pretty fragile.
Yeah, definitely takes every every grievance to social media to get, you know, positive feedback from followers and, you know, boost himself back up again.
Oh, no, yeah, it's one of those. A demon prince is definitely one of those who would actively search their name on social media.
Ooh, not just yikes.
Not just you know, look at their at mentions, but go right in and search for their name. So Kharan is the patron of lycanthropes, all sorts of werebeast, and other bestial creatures such as bugbears and gnolls and wargs and stuff like that. Clerics of Kharan are as bestial as the god that they serve. They despise civilization, and they love to destroy things, in particular, objects fashioned through craftsmanship, for such skills are alien to them. And I love the implication of that like they would walk into like an antique shop and just lose their minds.
Just wreck the joint.
Do you know what I mean? Cause yeah, like, you know, like, hey, like, you know, check out this, check out this ashtray that my kid made me in shop. I just smashed it on the ground.
This is alien to me, so I must destroy it.
I mean, on one part, it's utterly ridiculous. But on the other hand, I completely identify with that.
Yeah, as someone who destroys anything that's alien to me.
Or rather, you know, someone who would love to.
Yeah, fair enough.
So they wear furs and hides in battle, or they wear nothing at all. So it's like, you know, it's one or the other. It's, you know, there's no in between. Like they're either covered up and protected, or they're going, you know, the full Monty.
I can't imagine going into battle full Monty. The confidence that your average Kharan follower must, have is pretty incredible.
You know, in their self-image or in their self-preservation?
I guess both, really. Like, I mean, the idea that, like, not only am I going to go out there naked, I assume I'm going to win.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, that's just that's some next level. Like, you should be giving motivational speeches level of confidence.
Naked. You should be giving motivational speeches naked.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're one of the naked followers, if you go into battle in armor, I don't want to hear from you.
Yeah. You know, big deal. Big whoop. Whatever. But yeah, you go up there, like, you know, the last time I was dressed like this, I was in battle. So their hair is usually wild and flowing, and they are given to incoherent screams and grunts. They also undergo scarification as a part of their rituals. They also file their teeth into to sharp points if they're not already naturally sharp. Karan's temples are places of natural power, such as secluded glens, rocky outcroppings, deep pits in the wilderness. And they're always full of the bones of their prey, of sacrificial victims, and of fallen enemies. A fun D&D lorecast fact. Karan was a god included in the evil campaign I ran several years ago.
Oh, really?
He was the patron god of a group of lycanthropes that had infiltrated a town.
That's pretty cool. I love the idea too that Karan is actually a patron of werewolves. So does that mean he answers werewolf prayers? Like, you know, and are you there, Karan? It's me, Margaret, sort of.
It's me, Jacob. That's a Twilight joke, by the way.
That's a pretty good Twilight joke. I didn't catch that.
Yeah, I mean, he very much could, for sure. I mean, he isn't beholden to,
right, what
God is.
Yeah. He's no demon prince.
But no, yeah, absolutely. The second vile god we're going to discuss is also known as the Razor God, Ralistor. Ralistor is a deity of murder, a deity of torture, and a deity of psychotic behavior. So right now, like, this is getting into, like, the, you know, Scandinavian black metal, like corner of D&D, and I'm all for it.
My first thought reading the notes was like, I know that the description is different, but like the first thing that flashed into my head was Pinhead from Hellraiser, like in terms of like the Cenobites, that whole aesthetic, which I guess is Scandinavian metal in its own way.
For sure, you know, that whole sort of aesthetic. So religious scholars refer to Ralistor as the insane god and the god of madmen, but Ralistor's followers find him completely sane and comprehensible. Like, so, like, look, you just don't understand him like we do.
If you read your scripture,
if you really dove into the subtext of our holy text, so Ralistor is normally pictured as much like your Pinhead, as a tall, pale individual without wrinkles, but he has dark hair, unlike, as opposed to a bunch of nails covering.
Yeah, I mean, he still might have nails in his head. It's just that they're covered by the dark hair. That's my headcanon.
He's still got the nails, but he's got such a luxurious flow.
Like Warren Beatty 1970s hair.
For some reason, I'm picturing Mufasa from The Lion King.
So you've gone to a completely different species. Okay.
Well, I mean, he's still humanoid, but just sort of like the mane of hair that he has is like is enough to, it's, you know, the volume is such that it covers the nails. So upon a closer inspection, however, it reveals that his entire body is made of razors dripping with blood and also oil to keep the blades sharp and rust free. Ralistor's symbol is a toothy mouth clamped down on a bloody razor thin blade. And his favorite weapon is the short sword, which is something that I believe 5e has kind of gotten away from. But If you like sort of invoke a patron god, if you are, it's more so it's more so flavor text, but for a lot of, you know, character classes and all that. But if you were a follower of a god, that god usually has a favored weapon. And I always try to, if it, you know, fit my character, I always try to, you know, if their favorite weapon was like a short sword or a short bow, well, depending on if my character was melee or range, I would try to accommodate that, you know, just for the flavor text.
Yeah, absolutely.
The domains that Ralistor is associated with are evil. Okay, that goes beyond saying. Right. Destruction and pain, which definitely fits into that Cenobite vibe that you're going for. And he is obviously chaotic evil. I don't. If you tell me, like, hey, what alignment do you think this god is? He's completely made of razor blades, and his symbol is a bloody mouth biting down on a bloody razor blade. What alignment do you think he is? I'd be like, neutral,
lawful,
lawful, neutral. Maybe, I don't know. So many of his followers. Or many of his clerics are psychopaths and mass murderers who lurk in the shadows or discreetly in plain sight. You know, many of them act perfectly normal, maintaining a second identity as a shop clerk or even an artisan. But whether they camouflage themselves within society or remain apart from it, Ralistor's minions delight in torturing and killing their victims, usually in seclusion. Ralistor has very few temples, as his followers are usually loners, and as such, they keep secret shrines just for themselves. But each shrine has a small altar made entirely of razors.
You think you could get a Ralistor shrine on Etsy?
I don't see why not.
That's fair. I mean, like, if you're not crafty, let's say you used to be a Quran follower and, you know, making stuff is alien to you, but like you've changed.
It's sort of craftsmanship.
Right. But, you know, it's beyond you. You missed your window of learning how to do it. Like, but you want to get in on this. Like, you're like, no more God of the werewolves. I want the God of the madman.
I want the God of the psychopath.
Right. These followers sound way scarier to me that Quran's, like, the especially the ones who are hiding in plain sight as artisans and shop clerks.
Oh no, yeah, absolutely. And what I love about these vile gods is that you can plug them right into a campaign, as you know, as either a one shot or a small arc, you know, where there is a cult that infiltrates the city or even just a couple of followers, and, you know, start committing these heinous crimes in the name of their god. And, you know, it's up to the party to, you know, stop them, to figure out who it is and stop them. Like I said, it's not because these vile gods are, as I stated at the top of the show, don't have as much notoriety or don't have as many followers. Definitely have the notoriety, but not as many followers. You know, it doesn't seem as, you know, monumental as having to stop a cult of Vecna or a cult of Bane.
Right, right.
The third vile god that we're going to discuss is the Patient One. Waiting in the darkness, the Patient One, also known as the Dark Watcher, is a strange and alien creature, always whispering secrets to itself. Now, this is not to be confused with Tharizdun, who is also known as the Patient One, who is also considered a god in some lore, but also an elder evil in others. You know what, come to think of it, we'll jump into some Tharizdun lore in the second half of the show. That's, I just, and don't think that was just off the cuff. I definitely planned this. So the Patient One waits, until its time comes, and then it strikes, destroying or consuming everything in its path. Although never actually pictured in its entirety, the god is known to have many eyes, to have many mouths, and many clawed arms around its bulbous body. Sounds utterly disgusting. I don't know what is it about like human or about our brains that when we see something with a lot of eyes, it's completely disgusting to us.
I don't know. Maybe it's the same like thing that triggers the uncanny valley response. Like we have like something in our biology, something in our lizard brains is hardwired to recognize faces, right?
Right.
And we understand that faces traditionally have two eyes. And, you know, that's pretty much true across the mammalian kingdom and all that. But then you get into like other types of creatures like insects, spiders, things like that, that have these multiple eyes. And so it sort of jars with our idea of what a face should be. I'm just guessing. I don't like, have any hard data to back this up. But...
Well, that's sort of the theory is that, you know, because the uncanny valley is, you know, for those who don't know, is when... You know, something computer, usually computer generated, looks human enough, but is slightly off. Think the Polar Express, the animated movie,
CGI one, yeah.
And it's looks human enough, but is just slightly off. That it's completely, it makes us feel weird, you know, in a weird way. And the theory is that it's because there's something like you said hardwired in our lizard brain to recognize when something isn't human. Which is also wild to think of because, you know, why were we having to recognize something that looked human but wasn't human?
Right. Maybe it's, that's a good question. Like, what in our distant past is sneaking around trying to look human that we needed to develop this?
Exactly. So, or what in our distant past was, you know, walking around with dozens of eyes over their body and we had to be like, hey, stay away from that thing.
It may be patient, but once it's ready, you're done.
You're done for. He'll see you, and the many mouths too is so weird. So although some humanoids do worship this strange being, many more aberrations revere it. The patient one's temples are towers, often built on high hills in isolated areas, but because beholders and mind flayers are, you know, clerics and worshipers, the patient one's towers can also be found underground. At the apex of each tower is a stone altar, carved to appear as a mouth surrounded by eyes, of course, and then stained dark red with blood.
Nice.
So the patient ones obviously lives by the name patient. And one of the, you know, main dogmatic teachings is do not rush with decisions, think your plans through, and attack your enemies at the right moment. The whole world will be consumed by the Dark Watcher. Your job is to start the destruction.
But only at the right moment.
You don't want to jump the gun on the destruction.
Think it through. No weddings in Vegas. Unless you planned it that way.
Yeah, unless you're like, you know what, let's just do a shotgun wedding. That's different from an elopement. Shotgun wedding.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Think your plans through. That's interesting that they advise like patience, even though there is this idea that the whole world's going to be consumed by. Now, is the Dark Watcher the same thing as the patient one, or is that a separate entity?
No, they're it's just one of here's
one of its names.
Yeah, and here's something that you may be new to as far as the lore cast goes. We have come to the decision, and this is just based on stone cold facts, that if you're evil, you have cool nicknames. If you're good, you usually have pretty mid nicknames. Every so often, you get a cool one, but it's really the evildoers that have cool nicknames. And we'll definitely get to that when we talk about Tharizdun, because this dude has a million of them and they're all badass.
I guess that's why Aragorn is kind of scary when you first meet him, because he's got a pretty cool nickname. He's Strider.
Yeah. I mean, just the fact that he has a nickname and sounds pretty cool.
Right. I've been rewatching Lord of the Rings. I just wanted to get that reference in there.
As well you should. Tis the season for Lord of the Rings rewatches. The penultimate vile god that we'll be discussing in the first half of the show. Actually, no, we still got three more. So no, the
the anti-penultimate?
No, well, that would be the
semi-antipenultimate. I don't know what. Yeah, what
the next vile god we'll be discussing is Skarrasser, so known by all as the mistress of exquisite pain. Skarrasser is usually portrayed as a woman covered entirely in tight, studded black leather, so that even her face is concealed. She usually holds a whip and a hook. Temples to the mistress of exquisite pain are hidden behind false facade, which makes sense considering her appearance.
Mm-hmm.
The clerics of these temples often maintain front businesses such as bakeries or dairies or even like curiosity shops, with the temples accessible through hidden doors. The temple's rooms are soundproof to muffle the cries of pain. And although most of Skarrasser's clerics are compulsive about keeping their temples clean, it's usually impossible to keep the, you know, at least a dribble of blood or a loose tooth from dropping to the floor at any given time. Altars are usually Baroque monstrosities of spikes and spines and clamps and chains. And Skarrasser is related to another good deity, but the two deities have nothing to do with each other and conceal their relationship.
That's really interesting that they both by agreement.
And I love this. I love that the lore is, I feel, intentionally vague about this, because at that point you could just homebrew whatever, you know, good deity you want and sort of explain away like the relationship.
Right.
So Skarrasser is selfish and cruel and domineering. And so understandably so. You know, most of her followers. Skarrasser's clerics dress as their mistress does, preferring to hide their identities with leather or iron masks, and they're all sadists, although some are also masochists who prefer to give pain rather than actually kill. Sacrificial victims dedicated to Skarrasser often take days to die, for they are tortured to death, and in their minds, the more slowly, the better. Skarrasser's followers delight in the sounds of screams and in the sounds of tearing flesh. And because they try to prolong a victim's agony, many are actually skilled in the healing arts, which is wild. Because you're thinking like, I can't take much more of this. At least I'm going to die soon. And then all of a sudden they heal you.
For 20x, not XP, but HP. Yeah.
And so in their spare time, and I also love this, in their spare time, the clerics also devise new tortures and new torture devices.
Yeah, you know, it's like a homebrew.
kind of, yeah. I was going to say, like, you know, they're always better, right? That's always striving to be better. Always try to be better than the day before, right?
Yeah, every day and every day, every way, getting better and better.
Now, this is the penultimate vile god that we'll be discussing in the first half of the show. Not a single god, but the Zamix is an entity composed of at least six separate beings. The Zamix represents cold, analytical thinking taken to its extreme. And, you know, and Lore Mistress Mary and I have discussed this, the sort of... the hesitancy, like the pause we have when we do research on these evil gods or evil creatures or demons, find anything at all relatable. And I was like, oh yeah, cold analytical thinking. I like that. That makes sense. Why not?
Sure.
But of course, it's taken to its, you know, complete extreme. And so Zamix serves as the patron of utter indifference and of delving into forbidden knowledge through exploration and experimentation. Clerics of the Zamix are cold, uncaring beings who are fascinated by knowledge, which makes sense. I mean, if you are cold and analytical, you kind of have to be indifferent, right? You have no room for emotion.
Right.
They think nothing of dissecting living creatures simply to learn more about their biology. And they also place these creatures in torture chambers to see how long they can withstand terrible pain before their psyches crumble. I love the fact that it says that before their psyches crumble, not their bodies.
Right.
It does, they don't put them in these torture chambers to see how long they can physically withstand the pain, but rather mentally.
Do you think they ever set their victims loose after they're done breaking their psyches, just as like madmen and madwomen back into the world?
I mean, maybe that's how the patient one gets followed, or rather Rallister gets followers.
Maybe.
So the temples of Zamix are stark stone edifices filled with traps and ingenious locks, and white plaster often covers the interior walls, with altars dedicated to the Zamix always being made of polished steel. It reminds me of like an IKEA, to be honest.
yeah, it's I gotta say, of the altars described so far, this is the least interesting of all of them to me personally. I mean, if I'm signing up, I don't think this is the one for me.
I don't know that any of them. Well, I mean, before we started recording, you made me promise that at the end of the episode, we will decide which of these we will become followers of.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, that one seems the least interesting, and it also seems like the least insane, which is also worrisome.
Right. I don't want to join the least insane one. I mean, if I'm going for a vile god, I want to go a whole hog.
Yeah, let's come on. Yeah, let's not, you know, be, you know, skimping on the vileness here. Let's.
Yeah, exactly.
The final vile god in the first half is Yeathen, the god of evil depths, master of the last gasping breath, and lord of the deep darkness. Yeathen is a god of the sea. Once a simple water deity, Yeathen gradually brooded on dark, more mysterious matters until he became a neutral evil god of all things foul and malevolent about the sea.
So he basically contemplated himself out of neutrality and into evil. Well, I mean, I guess neutral evil.
But... Well, and into evil, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, yeah, it's hard to blame them. I feel like if I sat in the dark and just thought, I would eventually turn evil too.
Yeah, I feel like there's definite teenage edgelord vibes going on here.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, yeah, without interaction, if you just have to hang out at the bottom of the sea all the time.
Like, I feel if Bruce Wayne didn't have a trust fund, this is who he would have become.
Yeah.
Some Sahuagins, a few Kuatoas, and a fair number of Aboleths and their scum servants revere Yeathen, who is largely unknown among land dwellers, among the landlubbers. Yeathen's temples are always submerged and unlit, filled with sharks, octopi, and other strange denizens that are usually found in only the deepest undersea trenches. His symbol is a dark bluish green spiral with a black center. And this vile, neutral, evil god, their favored weapon is the trident, and they're associated with obviously evil, but as well as destruction and water domains. Clerics of Yeathen are quiet, brooding individuals with quick tempers and are usually wearing dark green and black. And if they are not native sea breathers, they are nevertheless accomplished swimmers, which I feel would signal me out. Like that would.
Oh, are you not a strong swimmer?
I'm not an accomplished swimmer. I mean, I can swim. Like, you toss me out into a into a lake, into an ocean, into a pool. You know, I can not drown.
Right. You won't drown in the bathtub.
No, not yet.
But not at the hale age of 40. Yeah.
But I don't think that I wouldn't call myself accomplished by any stretch.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, that accomplished is really what hangs you out. Yeah.
So we are going to ponder which of these we'll follow. We're going to take a break, go to the middle of the show. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Tharizdin and let y'all know which of these vile gods we will serve. Welcome to the middle of the show. Of course, the middle of the show is where we do all the middly things, like talk about recent D&D news, spotlight some homebrew shenanigans, and of course, thank all the listeners. Thank you so much for listening to the show, and extra special shout out to our patrons over at patreon.com/dndlorecast for supporting the show in that way. And thank you to Big Fat Boss, our newest patron. It's a fantastic name. I love it. If you are interested in getting some of the perks and benefits that are afforded to the patrons, definitely check out our Patreon. We have bonus content like two Patreon Plus installments each and every month. Those are deeper dives into the lore that we cover. We have a bonus episode every month. We have free merchandise for certain tiers. We have workshop sessions for certain tiers. At certain tiers, you're able to be invited to be a part of the actual plays that we're going to start up here in 2024. Definitely want to foster a community, grow a community, you know, just spread the love of D&D and TTRPGs in general. And so thank you to the folks who help make that possible in ways that we otherwise couldn't do. If you want to support the show in other ways, you can absolutely leave us 5-star reviews on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, all that stuff. You know, follow us on all the social medias. We are at D&D Lorecast pretty much everywhere. And just tell a friend. Tell a friend. Tell someone you think would be interested in the show. Hit us up with comments, constructive criticism, that sort of thing at dndlorecast@gmail.com. You know, anything that can make the show bigger and better for you, the listener. And in terms of D&D news, we've actually got a lot compared to the past couple weeks. The past couple weeks have been a little slow after the release of, or at least the digital release of the Book of Many Things and Deck of Many Things. We haven't had a physical release, but there is an update on that. Wizards just announced about a week ago or so that for U.S. players and stores, the Deck of Many Things should be getting in your hands around January 5th. Other parts of the world will be a little bit later than this, and they'll continue to update, you know, with an exact timeline. So it looks like you can actually get your hands on the physical copy right around the beginning of the new year. So that's exciting in terms of moving forward into 2024 and the 50th anniversary and the I don't know what to call them. I don't want to say remaster because that's what Paizo is calling their Pathfinder 2nd edition rule books, their new ones. But whatever they're calling the new books, the new core rule books that are coming out in 2024, they've released another playtest. They released an 8th playtest. It talks about the barbarian, the druid, the monk. So there's a link to that in the show notes. Definitely check it out. You know, tinker with it, play with it, use it in your one shots, maybe incorporate a rule or two into a campaign that you're already playing and see what works and see what doesn't. And then when the feedback opens up, we'll let you know and you can give feedback. This is one of the best ways to ensure that we get as good a game as possible. So definitely hit up D&D Beyond or just check the link in the show notes to check that out. More news. There is a this year's advent calendar or adventure calendar over on D&D Beyond. Every day you get something, some kind of benefit, some kind of perk. Yesterday was the first. So if this is the first you're hearing about it, then you've already missed out on that benefit. It was a discount on some of the D&D coffee that they sell. Not big unless you like the coffee, in which case you missed out. You're going to have to pay full price. Sorry to burst your bubble. But yeah, you get something cool. Like, you know, it could be some digital dice on D&D Beyond. It could be discounts on books and stuff like that. And a link to that will be in the show notes as well. Some more news. The U.S. Postal Service has revealed that they are going to release 10 different D&D stamps in 2024 to mark the 50th anniversary of Dungeons & Dragons. Described by its owners as the world's greatest role-playing game, D&D has become a cultural phenomenon by inviting participants to imagine themselves as wizards, warriors, and other adventurers in exciting and treacherous fantasy worlds. Dungeons & Dragons opened doors to whole new universes of creativity and for generations of players. Like I said, there will be 10 different designs that highlight characters, creatures, encounters familiar to players of the game. You've got Tiamat, you've got Dritz, you've got Asarak, you've got the cover from the Menser Basic Rules box set. It's D&D stuff. It's awesome. And I mean, I'm going to buy as many as possible. I'm not going to send, you're not going to get any letters from me. I guarantee you that. That's a lost art, but it's going to be awesome. And the final bit of news, it was a bit exciting to see that the Tal'Dorei campaign setting Reborn book was being made available on D&D Beyond as a, you know, as a digital copy. And now we're starting to see even more third-party content onto the website. We've got Ghostfire Gaming bringing two of their books, Grim Hollow, Lairs of Atharis, which showcases 20 horror fantasy adventures with more than 75 new monsters. And we've also got Dungeons of Drakenheim, which is a full campaign that is set in a ruined city for players to explore. And you probably know of it from the Dungeon Dudes podcast or YouTube channel. So again, very cool that we're starting to see third-party content. Hopefully that starts to continue on as D&D starts to pivot toward their own virtual tabletop. But yeah, I'm excited to see that. Dragonheim looks freaking fantastic. I'm a big fan of all things spooky, so should be come as no surprise. And as far as homebrew shenanigans goes, I looked up DM's Guild and I searched for Tharuzden, trying to figure out what we could find that would could have some kind of connection to the topic this week. And I found an adventure series called Lament for Lost Tharuzden. It's a two-parter, and you can actually get it bundled together with a discount. If you bought them separately, they'd be close to $8. If you buy them together, it's under $4. It's $3.95. So definitely look into getting the bundle rather than buying them individually. But it is, like I said, two-part adventure. The first part, The Amber Sarcophagus. Sing a lament for Lost Tharuzden. The wizard Beric has acquired something terrible in the mountains, and his folly has inflicted eternal winter on nearby villages. Delve into his keep, discover the nature of his experiments, and drive away the shadow before it spreads to consume everything. Now, this is a Ravenloft adventure, but doesn't necessarily have to be set in Ravenloft if you want to set it anywhere else. For characters of third level, the second part, Spear of Sorrow, snowstorms and disappearances blight the villages surrounding the Balinok Mountains. Investigate the rumors that a cult of elemental evil is involved and stumble across something altogether more sinister. Now, this one is for fourth level, so if you are going to play them back to back, you start off the Amber Sarcophagus with their party at third level. They level up, and then they start Spear of Sorrow. It looks freaking awesome. It's got 5-star reviews, and it's $3.95 for that price for two adventures. Can't go wrong. So definitely check it out. A show is included in the show. A link is included in the show notes. With that being said, let's jump back to the show. In the earliest days of creation, even before the gods and primordials began their terrible war, one god was not content with sharing power. He wanted absolute control over the nascent universe. This god, whose name is spoken only in panicked whispers, sought a source of power he could use to gain total dominion over the unfolding realms of creation. Somewhere in the infinite expanse of space, he found the weapon he sought in the form of a tiny shard of utter evil. The touch of the shard drove this god to madness, corrupting him so completely that he was no longer recognizable as his former self. Nevertheless, he carried the crystalline fragment into the depths of the universe, into the lowest reaches of the primordial vastness that would one day become the elemental chaos, and planted it there. Evil took root like a foul seed of corruption, burrowing deep into the unshaped matter of the elemental chaos and spreading unholy tendrils far and wide. A yawning chasm of infinite gloom and despair opened up at the lowest pit of creation, swallowing all matter and light, defiling anything that drew near. The Abyss was born. The evil of the Abyss corrupted even some of the mighty primordials, Demogorgon, Baphomet, Orcus, and reshaped them into the likeness of pure, destructive evil. The Mad God hoped to wield these demonic princes as weapons in his war of conquest, but they would not bend to his will or any but their own. So he left the Abyss and marshaled other elemental forces in his bid for domination. But the other gods overcame him, chaining him forever in the secret place known only to them. Now he is called the Chained God, or, by his demented followers, the Elder Elemental Eye. His only desire is to escape his prison, and he rarely spares a thought for the realm he inadvertently created. But the Abyss remains, a festering cyst beneath the elemental chaos. Within its lightless depths, demons erupt into birth, live out their short and violent lives, and are reabsorbed into the darkness. Demon princes rule their petty abyssal domains, scheming to destroy the gods and all their works. The god Loth hides in the demon web pits, corrupted and perhaps driven mad by the same power that shattered the chain god and made the first demon princes. And somewhere far beneath all imagining, the crystalline heart of the Abyss still beats its unceasing cadence of evil. Now that is what you call some top shelf lore. Like if there was a lore bar, and you asked for some lore, and they asked you like, "What do you want? Do you want the house?" He's like, "Actually, no. Let me get the top shelf stuff." They would pour you some of that. So that's a quick little excerpt on how the Abyss was created, and the Chained God. The nameless god, the Elder Elemental Eye, that is Tharizdun, an ancient dark god of malign decay and madness. Tharizdun seeks nothing less than the utter destruction of the universe, reducing all to literal nothingness. So Tharizdun, like I mentioned in the first half, has some of the dopest nicknames that we've had the pleasure of covering here on the Lorecast. I'm just going to start naming them off. You let me know if it's a pass or a fail as far as, how cool it is.
Okay.
The Dark God.
It's a weak pass.
Okay. The Ender.
That's a pass.
He of Eternal Darkness.
Pass.
The Ebon God.
Fail.
The Black Sun. Sun, S-U-N.
Sorry. I thank you for clarifying that. It's a pass.
This is why I had to bring him up earlier, the Patient One.
I'm just going to say fail because he's not the only one rocketing that nickname.
Okay. He Who Waits.
Fail.
The Anathema?
Pass.
The Father of Elder Evils?
Pass.
The Elder Elemental God?
Fail.
The Author of Wickedness?
A+ pass.
Absolutely. Woo! The Eater of Worlds?
Fail.
The Despised?
Fail.
The Undoer?
Fail.
The Chained God?
Pass.
And the Chained Oblivion.
I'd give that a stronger pass. Chained Oblivion has some flavor to it. It
absolutely does. But yeah, the Author of Wickedness, that's chef's kiss.
Yeah, I've never that's good. Yeah.
That's a good evil nickname. So eons ago, Tharizdun was imprisoned when the other gods put aside their differences and attacked in unison, fearing his dread dreams would come to pass. That's what we spoke of earlier that's why they call him the Chained God. So now Tharizdun is trapped alone in this prison demiplane from which he cannot free himself. However, his conduits to the material plane and the rest of the Great Wheel, while they are few and tenuous, they are still pretty fanatical about their worship. But only a few learned sages even know that Therizin was ever worshipped.
Interesting. That's like, so his priesthood is essentially pretty educated.
Well, no, yeah. I mean, you would have to be. I mean, this sort of knowledge is so archaic and so, you know,
esoteric.
Right. And that you would have to be pretty educated to get to this level. You know, this isn't something that in the parlance of our time, you know, you probably wouldn't even have a Wikipedia page.
Right.
And if it doesn't have a Wikipedia page, does it even exist?
No.
There you go. So under cover of darkness, cults of his insane priests labor tirelessly to free their dark master from his prison, hoping to aid him in the destruction of all. Therizin's cultists call him by many names, such as the ones that we mentioned. He also grants spells in the guise of the elder elemental evil. And those who follow his dogma believe that the very threads that weave the universe together must be torn asunder, then burned, then the ashes scattered, until all is nothing and no one exists to remember existence.
I mean, it's pretty thorough.
It's pretty bleak, but yet it's so awesome. I mean, I don't know. And maybe my brain is broke.
No, I mean, look, I'll lay it out there. Existence is a prison, and
let's just call it what it is.
Yeah,
there was right.
you know, if I'm in this world, I'm at least going to the TED Talk.
At least I'm hearing them out. I'm giving them 15 minutes. So an inscription in one of Therizin's black pyramids says, "Light must be snuffed, perfection decayed, order dissolved, and minds fragmented." The dark whispers.
That also sounds like a. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say that just sounds like a description of an awesome party.
Start at the beginning.
Okay. I mean, honestly, that sounds like the description of an awesome party.
I mean, if I'm 23, I get handed a flyer. That's, you know, with an address, and it says light must be snuffed, perfection decayed, order dissolved, and minds fragmented. You know, $5 at the door. I'm like, yeah, I mean, why not? I've got $5. Let's go.
All my plans are canceled. Let's go.
So the dark whispers of he who waits are entropy themselves. So his dogma doesn't get much more complicated than that. I mean, it doesn't get much more complex than like just destroy everything, leave nothing behind. Given the insanity that's rampant among his clerics, any discussion about Therizin will often degenerate into screams and ululations, which just sounds like the internet. I mean, that's probably what it is. So.
Yep.
I mean, the more I'm reading about Therizin, the more, like, you know, unpacking the research and the lore, it sounds kind of like the society we live in now.
Yeah.
Many of Therizin's clerics don't even realize that they are worshiping He of Eternal Darkness, since the power actually hides behind other aspects and other names, most notably the Elder Elemental Eye. Those who do know the truth are offered great power, but at the price of one's own sanity. The more dark blessings a cleric of Therizin receives, the more tenuous their grip on reality. The Chain God's few remaining temples and unholy sites are far from civilization and well hidden. Because after all, the public knowledge of a site devoted to Therizin is enough to raise an entire army of crusading paladins. Like I said, this is something that the layman probably wouldn't recognize the name, but you know, a paladin who devotes their life to smiting evil definitely would know who Tharuzdin is.
Right.
And definitely would want any sort of temple or worship site dedicated to He Who Waits destroyed as quickly as possible. So as a result, cults of the Eater of Worlds guard these sites carefully and rarely stray from them, for their dark god has great difficulty granting spells far from the ancient sites that were once devoted to him. And like I said, Tharuzdin has been around for a while as far as that, you know, the lore goes, but has also been around a while in terms of the game itself. He has his origins all the way back to the first edition of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, and he's made his way through second edition AD&D, third and fourth editions. And if you've played through or even read Princes of the Apocalypse or Ghosts of the Saltmarsh, you know that he and his cultists are still very much around Faerun, causing trouble, trying to free him from his prison, you know, demiplane. And not just Faerun, but Exandria, as Matt Mercer from Critical Role uses the Elder Evil as one of the betrayer gods when he was constructing the lore of his personal campaign setting.
It's a fun fact.
It's a little fun fact. And if you're listening, if you're a critter, if you love Critical Role, or if you're interested about learning more about Critical Role, drop me a line. Let me know if you're interested in learning more about their lore. I mean, a lot of it is very similar, or at least inspired by the D&D lore, you know, with some changes. For example, you know, Tharuzdin is one of the betrayer gods, and that's why he is imprisoned in the Exandria world. But yeah, if you're interested in learning more about Critical Role, I would not mind digging into that lore as well. So yeah, if you're interested, drop me a line, dndlorecast@gmail.com, or Discord, or any of the social medias.
I still need to join that Discord. I'm going to do that before we get off the line. I'm going to have you walk my old man self through the process of getting on that Discord.
You're part of Discord. You are on several Discords.
I know, but I'm never, it always feels like a small miracle that I arrive anywhere I'm supposed to be when it comes to Discord.
So we've reached the end of the show, and as promised, we are going to reveal which of the, from the first half of the show, which of the vile gods we would consider being followers of. We have Karan, Rallister, the Patient One, Skarasar, and Zamix and Yeethan. I think we can both say the Zamix is getting ruled out. It's a little, yeah, a little too tame. If we're going vile, we're going full vile.
Right.
Yeethan, again, for me personally, I'm not an accomplished swimmer.
I'm not now, but in my younger days, I was considered a veteran of my apartment complex's swimming pool. I spent a lot of time in that pool. Honestly, I mean, I guess just Yeethan is the one that I would probably end up following, not because I want to brag on my swimming skills, but just because the underwater, you know, behemoths and stuff, it's very Lovecraftian. I mean, all of this stuff is, you know, very Lovecraftian in a way, but like this specifically, like he has several stories that delve deep into ocean dwelling ancient, you know, evils and things like that. And so that imagery really resonates for me. I love this idea of, you know, the temples always being submerged. I mean, I'd probably drown at my first meeting, but I would still try to join, I think, if I, you know,
if, well, I, you had probably to have choose some sort of like unholy magic, some evil magic keeping you alive, like helping you breathe underwater.
Yeah, of course I do.
I mean, if you were to become a follower of Yeethan, for sure.
Yeah. If I signed up at the job fair.
Or you would, your body would be horribly mutilated and transformed so that you could breathe underwater.
Ooh, yeah. Let's go with that. I also love the idea that he literally just brooded himself into this. Like, he put himself into a bad mood for all time.
For all and time.
No one has talked him out of it. I identify strongly with that.
Fair enough.
How about you?
For me, I'd probably go Rallister.
Okay.
Rallister, the deity of murder, torture, and psychotic behavior.
Sure.
It's, you know, it's very archetypical of evil, you know? It's the evil archetype, it's the evil stereotype, but, you know, sometimes the classics are classics for a reason.
And he has that great hair.
And he has that great mane of hair. And he may or may not have nails in his head. But just, and also that, you know, they are mass murderers, psychopaths, but they lurk in the shadows or discreetly hide in plain sight, which is always, you know, in real life is always the most terrifying thing about, like, these truly evil people who commit these heinous acts. And they were, you know, like, their kid was
on my kid's soccer team. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Like, he seemed like such a nice guy. He never would have done something like that.
But now that you mention it.
So yeah, so I'm going Rallister all the way.
I think that's a good choice. That would have been my second choice. If there hadn't been a cool underwater deity, I probably would have gone with Rallister too.
And also, like, the symbol, like the toothy mouth clamped down on a bloody razor thin blade already kind of looks like I can imagine it, and it kind of already looks like the logo of a punk rock band I would have loved as a high schooler.
That's exactly what I was thinking too.
Like, I could, like, see that patch on my hoodie.
Yep.
So, you know, it checks all sorts of boxes for me.
You should have the listeners chime in with which vile god they would
No, yeah, I was going to say, absolutely. So jump on the Discord. If you need me to, I can walk you through how to join as I'm going to walk Sean through. But yeah, let us know which vile god you would rather, you know, who you would pick to be a follower of. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Sergio.
My name is Sean.
Fare thee well, dear listener. And until we meet again, may all your 20s be natural.
Thank you for listening to the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. If you've enjoyed the show, consider following us on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at D&D Lorecast, or jumping into the Robots Radio Discord to chat more with us about Dungeons & Dragons. We'll see you soon.
You've been listening to a Robots Radio podcast. Smart shows for interesting people. Check out all the shows at robotsradio.net.